Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona, it's time for Valley Business Radio, spotlighting the Valley's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Hello and welcome to Valley Business Radio, where we tell the stories that traditional media tends to ignore and help connect you to the right people. I'm your host, Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and I'm joined in the studio this morning by Sila Farani-Simmons, a learning, leadership, and organizational development expert with North Central University. Welcome, Sila.
Thank you so much. So happy to be here.
Thanks for joining us. And Jonathan Kaiser, CEO of Kaiser, one of the fastest growing commercial real estate firms in the country, and a leader who's really hung it all out there in his recent book, You Don't Have to Be Ruthless to Win. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thanks for inviting me.
So I'm excited about this conversation because while you both work in very different types of organizations, you have something in common. You're passionate about people and about getting the best out of people and by creating the best culture and environment for people to flourish. You've come at it from different perspectives. I think we're going to have a fascinating conversation as we learn more about each of you. Sila, why don't you start us off here with a little bit of your backstory. How did you end up in the learning and development field?
So I was supposed to be an activist growing up. I'm a former refugee from Afghanistan. I had seen war growing up, and it was in my mission to be a journalist or an activist in some capacity. And I graduated college in the late 90s, so right as the world of journalism was beginning to change. And I wanted to be Anderson Cooper, and they wanted me to report on the newspaper delivery guy in Omaha, Nebraska. And it just wasn't a fit by the time I graduated college. And so I joined the corporate workforce, and I've always been interested in people. I've always been interested in people's experiences. And the space that I gravitated to naturally with that background was the people space in business. And I've been there for the past 20 years now.
There's certainly something to the refugee experience that indelibly marks your outlook, sometimes by having you be extra resourceful and dynamic and see opportunities where there aren't any. Sometimes, having worked with a lot of displaced populations around the world, it can be crippling for an individual, for a group. How did you begin to realize, as you've shared it more, that your personal experience as a young woman coming into adulthood, finding your way, was going to suit this kind of work? How did you connect those dots?
That's such a good question. I'm not really sure that I even consciously connected those dots. It just felt like the most appropriate space for me, the place where I could have the greatest impact in the business world. I think having had the experience that I have, it allowed me to connect with people on a deeper level. And so that in and of itself just was a natural pull into the people space, into the HR learning, professional development space, because that's where I could really build these deeper connections that I'm actually really interested in building. If you put me in behind a desk where I have to do spreadsheets all day, you're probably not going to get the best out of me.
And I think that informs some of your work. You and I have discussed in the past how you talk often with leaders, with the people you coach in your own organization, and in your role as a speaker and consultant. You're always addressing these layers of identity and how to kind of find the best fit for people. This is something that we hear commonly, you know, making sure they're in the right seat on the bus and things of that nature. But there's something deeper and more human about what you're talking about. Can you explain this concept of the shifting in multiple layers of identity?
Yeah. There's so many different identities that we each carry. Certainly, yes, I'm a former refugee, but I'm also the youngest child in a family of three. And I'm married to a man from Louisiana, and I happen to live in North Scottsdale, right? All of those are a bunch of different identities. And there's an intersection of all of those identities. And I think humanity meets at that intersection where we all connect, right? At the end of the day, we have the ability to impact each other. At the end of the day, you have the ability to hurt me or you, or the degrees vary depending on the relationships, or we can build each other up. We have that ability too. And I think it's that intersection of all of these various identities. And that's like the root of human nature. If we can connect in that space where we recognize each other's real quote-unquote humanness, I think there's a lot of beauty in that space.
So you've worked for over 20 years across multiple industries, from finance to retail, hospitality, healthcare, higher education. And in every one of those industries, there are things that everybody knows mm-hmm. about how we do things around here, some of which are not always good, mm-hmm. right? And at the same time, you're trying to help people find their own unique expression within their organization. And this begs, at least to me anyway, a sort of obvious question. We pay a lot of lip service to this thing called authenticity. Uh-huh. We're asking people to express themselves fully and truthfully in a way. When there are so many layers of our identity, what is authenticity?
Yeah. And you know, by the time something becomes super mainstream, I think we at that point adopt the simplest interpretation of it. So things get diluted, like even authenticities become diluted. But, you know, I go back to actually one of the things you talk about, Adrian, when you talk about the three stories we tell. You know, one is the story you tell about yourself to yourself, and the story you tell about yourself to other people, and then the story that others tell about you to others. And so to me, the root of authenticity really is the story you tell yourself about yourself. You got to take ownership and authorship of that narrative. And too many of us leave that to chance. And then what happens is become disconnected from our own story about ourselves. And then that totally messes up the other two stories completely. And there's no congruence between the three stories. So I think it starts with taking ownership of your own narrative and then owning that and living it.
That's such a powerful insight. And it's a great moment here to turn to Jonathan Kaiser, who's attempted to do something like this in his book, You Don't Have to Be Ruthless to Win. We'll talk about the book and your own personal storytelling in this, Jonathan. But first of all, give us some context about Kaiser. Who do you serve? Kind of the scope of your work. It's a very multifaceted and fast-moving company.
Yes.
So how do you describe Kaiser to
sure.
new folks?
So one, Kaiser is a mission-driven organization. Our mission is to change the business world through selfless service and prove that you don't have to be ruthless to win. So that the title for my book came out of the mission that we have in the organization. What we do from a business standpoint is we help corporate users of space with everything relative to their real estate needs. So if you think about traditional commercial real estate firms, they primarily represent landlords, developers, and real estate investors. And in the process, tenants get the short end of the stick. And so we as an organization exclusively represent the tenant of commercial real estate and give them an advocate that's really for them. But at a broader level, what we really do is bring this mindset, this attitude, this way of being of selfless service to every interaction, both internal and external. And as a result, we're able to create extraordinary success for ourselves and for our clients, because we believe that at the end of the day, you know, one of my business principles that I want to be known for is selfless service is the greatest business principle of all time. And I truly believe that.
Now, let me push back on this a little bit, because the very title of your book in some ways is calling out the entire industry that you operate in. And without throwing any one individual organization under the bus, you're making some strong claims here in the book about the nature of the industry you came up in, where in fact, the commonly held belief is you do have to be ruthless to win.
Yes.
So this book is a direct shot into that mindset with love,
yep,
and an attempt to show that another way is possible. But you didn't start out this way.
No.
Talk to us about your own journey in the real estate business. There's some fascinating backstory in the book I want to probe a little bit further.
Sure.
You selling phone service in Spanish on, yep, the sidewalk, things, yep, of that nature. But there's a moment when you end up in commercial real estate and you start trying to make it.
Right.
What was that world like?
Well, for me, I was raised by by Christian missionary parents. And actually, I didn't realize that you were an Afghanistan refugee because Fariba, who's one of my adopted sisters, Afghanistan refugee as well.
Oh my goodness.
And so that's so cool. I'll have to share that story offline. Yes. We also have one from another part of the world who's just amazing, that's from Bosnia. Amazing. But anyways, so, you know, my mindset growing up, I was taught to love and serve and give. The problem was when we got back from overseas, I realized in this kind of moment of epiphany that we were poor and I didn't like being poor. So I decided at an early age that I was going to be rich, and I got into commercial real estate brokerage because a friend of mine said you could be rich. And then as soon as I got in, I realized really quickly, wow, this is a cutthroat industry, right? And I actually love the industry. I have some of my best friends are in the industry. And I actually wrote a title, or one of the titles of one of the chapters of my book is Trapped in the Crazy Commercial Real Estate Industry. I think there's a lot of people that don't want to be ruthless, that wish there was another way, but don't see there as being another way. And because the industry has this culture of hyper-competitiveness, they just fall in like I did, right? So for me, as I got in, I became ruthless because I thought that's what it took. And again, I didn't want to be poor like my parents. And I had this mindset that helping other people led to the poorhouse. So why would I want to do that? And then as I did it, I kept losing more and more of myself, and I felt more and more miserable and unhappy, but I felt trapped. And then 15 years ago, I go to this conference and the speaker gets up and he starts talking about a different way of doing business. And I'd never heard anything like it. And it sounded like my parents. I'm like, there's no way. This guy's so full of crap. So I went up to him afterwards and I said, come on, tell me the real deal. There's no way that you're successful doing what you just described. And he said, no, actually I am. And he likened it to farming versus hunting, right? Of developing, nurturing. I have a lemon tree in my backyard that right now I get so many lemons, like I don't know what to do with them. It's almost a nuisance. But when it was a baby, for years and years, I'm like, come on, just give me a lemon. And it's kind of like that creating and helping relationships. And so I decided at that point I was going to reinvent myself, came back to Arizona from that conference, threw my business plan away, and just started getting involved in the community and helping everybody that I could. And people thought I'd gone off the deep end. People thought I'd lost my mind, hit my head or something. Because here I was, National Rookie of the Year for a big national firm. Looks like I was on the fast track. And now all of a sudden I'm like looking like a free community concierge asking everybody, how can I help you? But over time, it was a long, hard road, but over time I created enough relationships where people started appreciating what I had done and they started referring commercial real estate business to me. And so over time, and so I talk about all the time, this is the long game. This isn't the short game. This isn't a get rich quick scheme that I'm talking about. This is long-term sustainable success. But if you really love and serve and put others first over time, you create an extraordinary environment where people can help you back.
Let's talk about time for a minute, not to be, you know, regressing to philosophy class, but I think time is so important. And we are as confused about time as we are about money and about sex. These are just things that human beings get screwy about. Of course, the period at the end of our time frame is death. So we're definitely messed up about that. But there's two temporalities in your book. There's the part one, which is your personal story. And it's a fascinating journey from your childhood in Papua New Guinea to your return to the States, spending some time with a family member in a remote part of New Mexico.
New Mexico, yeah.
And then, you know, bouncing around back and forth, the kind of and then time frame of a personal journey.
Sequential, yes.
Right? And then you get to part two of the book, which is now, here's what we've learned. Here's how we're running our company. Here are the 15 core operating principles that Kaiser is building our empire of selfless service on.
Yes.
Why don't you try this too?
Yes.
And the time frame in the second part of the book changes to the time frame of anecdotes or examples. So, you know, illustrating the principles. Here's my question. And this points to something, by the way, that I think is really, really hard to pull off. The question is, what happened to the middle part? In other words, there's your personal journey and the lessons you learned along the way, the things that should have been obvious. It's really admirable the way that you narrate this part of your life. It's a hard thing to do.
Thank you.
To look at things that, again, you know, your parents kind of had this message all along, but you were the arrogant, egotistical young man who didn't want to end up like them,
yep.
only to come full circle and realize there's something there, right? Yeah. That's cool. Like, that's a mature outlook. There's got to be a lot of stuff from the dark years, once you got the idea mm-hmm. and started trying to pull it off.
Yes.
Before the great examples of, and this is how this works, and this is how that works, and this yes. is how this paid off, that partly because it would be long if you tried to write all the gory stuff.
Yes.
Partly because nobody cares about hand-wringing and like, and then I went home and I was miserable and I got in another argument or, you know, things of that nature.
Yes.
What you're inviting people to do is cross that chasm themselves with your example leading the way.
Mm.
And yet it's hard to know whether or not that's a good idea.
Mm.
Is this, you see where I'm going with this?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if people buy into you, the persona that you're creating that says, hey folks, I've been through this.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you what it was like. Come along on this journey. By the way, this is the destination.
Yeah.
Right? There's a middle part where you do say, look, this is going to be hard. It's going to take longer than you thought. You're going to question yourself. Everyone's going to think you're crazy. How much of the time frame was that middle part? Was that a year, 5 years, 10 years?
It was about 5 years. So when I decided to reinvent myself, I was told, one of the things when I asked the speaker, I said, okay, if this really is true, why is nobody else doing it? Right? How come this is the first time I've ever heard of this? And he said, because it takes too long. And I said, well, what does that mean? He said, it'll take you about 5 years to really reinvent yourself. And what I know now that I didn't know then is part of the long, part of why that's so long is because you actually have to reinvent yourself. And until you do, it doesn't actually start to work. And so I spent a few years trying to manipulate, right? Thinking that if I gave you this, then you would give me something in return. So it was this bartering kind of mindset versus this all-in selfless service philosophy. But it was couched in an all-in selfless service philosophy. And I realized in an epiphany moment with my coach that I was completely and utterly full of crap, right? And here I am out talking about how I love and serve people, and all I'm doing is a more creative way to manipulate. And I'm like, oh gosh. And it was at that moment that I just realized, screw it. I'm just going to go all in. I'm going to help everybody that I can, and I'm going to let the chips fall where they may. And that's when it took off. So if people are enlightened enough to avoid the first few years of my journey, they can really compact that time frame. But regardless, when you're a type A driven, take no prisoners, ruthless commercial real estate broker like I used to be, and you try to become a selfless servant, no matter how much you were raised with it, that is a tremendous shift. And so part of what we write about in the book is three levels of reinvention, right? How do you do that? How do you actually do this? Because this book, when I wrote the rough draft and I got some feedback from people, the number one thing they said is, Jonathan, it's inspirational, but there's no how-to in it. Like, it leaves us hanging. Like, okay, now we want to do this. What do we do? And so we went back and rewrote the second half to make it really prescriptive and to give tons of resources and tons of advice and tons of examples. Because my goal with this book is for people to be able to pick it up and take all the secrets and tools and tips that I've learned for the last 20 years of trial and error and actually implement this in their own business, right? And I think part of the challenge is we all know how to love and serve. We all do it in our homes, hopefully. We all do it in our social groups and our personal networks. And then we get into business and we have this philosophy like, okay, I got to go put on my tough suit and I got to go fight for number one and I got to bring home the bacon and all these terms that we all know. And my point to everything is, why? Why is there this disconnect between what we claim to already know and what we do in the most important area of our life, and yet somehow hasn't trickled into business? And the reason how I solve for that is I believe that it's because there's not enough people out there doing it and talking about it. So I wrote this book, and a lot of people are like, why would you tell all your competitors all your secrets? It's like, because this isn't about me. I want to change an industry. I want to change a business world. I want to show that it is possible, even in arguably one of the most ruthless industries in the world, to be successful by loving and serving other people. So to answer your question, kind of coming back around to it, this book is designed to say, here's an example of someone that used to be a, use the explicative, and now lives to serve other people. It's possible. And then that leaves you kind of hanging going, okay, then how? Part two says, here's how you do it, yeah. Right? And it's like, and the fortitude required, that middle part, that depends on the individual. Because if they read my book and they take those things to heart, they can do this really, really quickly. But if they're stubborn and bullheaded and arrogant and unaware like I used to be, it's probably going to take you longer. And so part of the things that we've done at Kaiser is saying, okay, one, how do we go identify those people that are already pre-wired this way, that wish they could be in business, in commercial real estate and be successful, but keep feeling like they get trampled because they're trying to be the good guy? It's like, how do you show that good guys win? And that's the philosophy of this. And then we wanted to matriculate out into other industries.
I just realized, Jonathan, as you were talking, something I hadn't realized before. And I've read this book. I led a discussion group with a bunch of folks from the Conscious Capitalism of Arizona chapter on this book where we talked a lot about it. But this only hit me just now. In telling this story and inviting people on this journey with you, there's one common storytelling trope that you don't use in the book. And I'm now realizing I'm glad you didn't. And that is the fall from grace narrative to like the pits of despair and then build yourself up. So if you think of folks like Kurt Vonnegut, who not only was a brilliant author, had a master's degree in anthropology from the University of Chicago, wrote his master's thesis on the shape of stories. One of the common shapes is something starts off high, then plummets down low, and then climbs up again. And you often in business books find this story. You also find this in Christian redemption narratives, you know, the youth speakers and people who are talking about don't do drugs, it'll wreck your life. It often starts like this. I was very successful. I had everything I ever wanted. I had money. I had cars. I had women. I had, you know, drugs. I had it all. And then it crashed and burned and I was in the gutter and it was horrible. And there was a moment where I saw the light. This is a classic thing. It actually occurs in multiple religious traditions, but it's often used in contemporary world. And then I turned myself around and reinvented myself. And now here I am standing before you telling you don't do those bad things. Now, if you've ever been a teenager listening to a youth speaker, the sex and drugs and cars actually sounds a lot more attractive than where he's trying
like,
to get.
How do I sign up for that part? That sounds good.
Go back to that part a minute ago. I had the Lambo. Tell me more about the Lambo. So you're not doing that in this book insofar as you're not trying to tell an epic story of failure, prison redemption kind of in the gutter sort of a thing. What you are saying is, I failed and 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 failed and failed some more. And I kept having to get out of my own way. And I had a coach. This is the theme in your book. There's a mentor guide kind of character that emerges here.
Steve Hardison.
Right? I had Yoda. I had Steve Hardison. I kept having to discover that it was there for me all along. I just had to take it. And I'm glad you didn't, because that, well, it makes for compelling storytelling sometimes. That other form is so hackneyed at this point, I think it becomes less believable. And furthermore, here's the real pitfall. People would read it and go, well, I would never be that dumb.
Totally.
I would never do that.
Totally.
As you put this book together, you were trying to reveal your own humanity, warts and all.
Yes.
Some of them anyway. I'm sure like all of us, you can't.
I got a lot.
You can't fit it all in, right? There's other angles and other people have different perspectives. No. Yeah. You don't know the half of it. Let me tell you about Jonathan Kaiser.
Totally.
But what you're trying to do is get people to realize, hey, look, you see me now, and I may have things that you want. I may have a successful company. I may have some you know, admiration from my peers and from the community and whatever. But let me tell you, it wasn't always this way. And if you're interested in going where I'm going, here's how to come along with me. Was that a conscious effort in trying to model your story in a way that would speak to others. That's not an easy thing to do. Yes. How'd it go as you were writing the book?
Oh man. Well, first of all, thank you for the kind words. This is a book that's 8 years in the making. You know, I had a podcast yesterday and one of the questions was, what was the hardest thing about the book? And I go, oh my gosh, how much time do you have? You know, the idea of getting a vision out of your head into a way that's compelling to others. And then to hear, you know, when I did that rough draft, it was rough because people were honest and I asked them to be, and they'd say like, oh, this part was terrible and you got to do this. And so it was kind of like this endless trying to find that balance between, I didn't want it to be an autobiography. It's not about me. It's about telling others they can do it. But without enough of the story, it didn't set the context and nobody could kind of understand what I was talking about. And so I tried to find that balance where the first third is, here's how I did it. And then packing most of the content of the book with here's how you do it for yourself. But I mean, at the end of the day, I want the whole point of this book is to show other business leaders that it's possible to create success through service. And that if I, by being vulnerable, we talked about the word authentic, by being transparent, whatever word you want to use, can help others go, okay, so let's see. So you were reasonably successful doing it the other way. We all know you can succeed by being ruthless. We have people at the highest forms of government that prove that daily. But that there's also another way. Yeah. Right. And so it's not like, hey, I have the only way, follow me, I'm the Pied Piper. It's not that at all. It's just, hey, what if, just as a possibility, you, Mrs. Business Leader, don't have to behave ruthlessly to get ahead.
And if I could add to that, we talked a little bit about time, and it takes too long. Here's what we do know. We know for a fact that the way that we work today does not work. Mm. People are miserable, right? Like you can look at all the engagement surveys. Yep. People are absolutely miserable. So we know that it doesn't work. The current way doesn't work. But you know why it doesn't seem like it's taking that long to us? Because we've assumed those risks. Mm. We say, this is the norm, and we do what our parents did, and our parents did, and our parents did, right? This is how we do work. You're supposed to be miserable. You're supposed to hate your boss, right? But I think what you're saying is so compelling because you're saying you've assumed that risk and it doesn't stand out to you. Give this a shot.
Yes.
You know, why does this look so risky to you? You know the current way doesn't work. Why is this so risky?
Yeah. Sheila, you have worked with a lot of senior leaders in a variety of different industries. And I imagine in your role as an internal coach, facilitator, sounding board, really doing leadership development with the leaders, not just trying to get their people to perform better, you run into, in private and confidential conversations, some of the roadblocks that Jonathan Kaiser is running into with his own coach. Can you speak to your experience, obviously, with anonymity and generalities and all that sort of thing? When leaders struggle to wrap their heads around some of these core principles, how to give, how to take bold action, one that I really want to talk about, how to create a culture that embraces mistakes, not just accepts them, embraces them. What sorts of stumbling blocks do you find over and over again in your one-on-one work with leaders at the highest level?
People are scared of being taken advantage of. I don't want my team to take advantage of me. I don't want this person to take advantage of me. And if I show up as my whole self, warts and all, because we all have them, if I show you my warts, will you take advantage of me? Will you use it against me? Will it harm me in some way, right? Will you think less of me? Before I put on my corporate armor, whether it's jeans or suits or whatever, before I put it on, maybe I really struggle with, am I even capable of doing what I'm trying to do? Am I acting or am I really capable of leading an organization or leading a team? And I think it's that fear that gets in the way a lot. And what I like to tell people is there are going to be instances where you are taken advantage of. There are. That's, you know, it'll happen. But I would bet that there are probably deeper and better and greater relationships and outcomes that you'll experience if you're willing to put a little bit of yourself out there, even at the risk of being taken advantage of. And oh, by the way, even if you hide your warts, there's still going to be people who, who might take advantage of you here.
Right. Pretending is no guarantee that you're not going to get played. One of the things that strikes me as so fascinating, the kind of highest possible level here, is that human beings in general are a species that seems so desperate to hide our humanity from every other member of the species so nobody figures out we're human.
So true.
And we somehow have it like, if we just play this game and everyone thinks we're superhuman, even though we don't feel we are, then we're somehow going to make it and get ahead. And literally everybody's doing this. How do you begin to shift the culture of an organization to a place where the kind of acceptance, the kind of psychological safety, to pull one of those insider buzzwords, is there and people believe, oh no, it really is okay. Because man, the fear of threat, the fear of, retribution, whether it's from HR or from a team leader or from, probably worst of all, the chattering masses at the water cooler, is so real.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that?
You know what? The best way to make that happen is to have people like Jonathan, business leaders who take the horse by the reins. Is that a correct idiom to use?
It sure is.
We're going to go with it today. It is really the business leaders, the people who have control, quote unquote, of the environments, making it safe and making it okay. If we say one thing, like, hey, we believe in psychological safety and we believe in authenticity, but we reward another, the leadership team rewards another, guess what becomes part of the culture? It's what you reward, it's not what you say. And the only way to live it is to have business leaders, like Jonathan is explaining to us right now, just set the standard for that behavior in the organization and reward the things that are human instead of going for the things that are not.
Let's talk for a minute again,
I love that.
In general terms about this. In every large organization and many small ones, there are people like you who are committed to empowering others, sometimes working against the trend of the culture in that environment. Why is it that one of the things everybody knows about leadership development programs is that they very often don't work?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that one of the things everybody knows about the workforce in general is that engagement is down, measures of happiness are down? Given that there are people committed to making things happen, what needs to change? Obviously, change it at the top, but how do you do that? And what else needs to change?
So leadership development is something like a $366 billion industry globally, and it has a pitiful success rate. It's like something like 75% of leadership development programs fail. And it's sad. And I have a theory on that. And my theory is that leadership development, so I'll use the example that I use frequently, and I don't know a Pete, but let's call this guy Petty Pete.
Petty Pete.
Petty
okay.
Pete. And let's say that you work for a guy named Petty Pete. Okay, so Petty Pete is going now to a leadership seminar because he needs to enhance his leadership skills. And he goes and takes crucial conversations and learns how to give feedback and all that good stuff. Now he comes back to the workforce. Is he now a less petty person? That was his issue, right? He was kind of a petty person and he was giving petty feedback and he was being a petty leader, taking crucial conversations. Will that make him less petty? Or did we just equip him with everything he needs to give petty feedback better, right? So my point being that leadership development is really personal development, and you can't have these cookie cutter things. I mean, certainly crucial conversations and feedback and all that is very important, but you can't have these cookie cutter things. And until we allow the authentic and whole person to show up in the workplace where I can show my warts, and then you can give me the ointment that I need for my warts, going with this really horrible metaphor now, but we're not going to find the solution for it. So it has to be personal. Leadership development is personal development. It has to be unique to the person. It has to address that person's needs. And until we're willing to look at each other as personal, complete human beings in the workplace, we're not going to reap the rewards that we could.
Yeah. Jonathan, in your book, you talk about the three levels of reinvention. In other words, look, it's not enough to have a personal transformation and to shift the way you view yourself and the world and have that reorganize your actions and things. You do need to reinvent yourself through selfless service. That's level one in your book. You also need to reinvent your company culture through selfless service. It's level two. And level three is reinventing your approach to your clients and collaborators through selfless service. So this is not navel gazing. This is not, I'm going to make me better so that I'll do better business and get better results. You're really out to transform some things that are not under your direct control. How do you do that?
Well, this is a revolution from the inside out. Right? It's an inside out reinvention. And that's why I just love what you just said, because two questions ago, you asked about how do you get people to do it? And you answered perfectly. And it's consistent with what I've always said is a fish rots from the head. So the hardest part about being a selfless leader, drum roll, the very hardest part is you actually have to be a selfless leader. That's the hardest part. You can't just lead by telling other people to do it, right? Because nobody's going to do it. So to become a selfless leader, you have to reinvent yourself. That's that personal work. It is highly personal, right? And so what I say is, for anybody that just wants to use my book as a tactic, you're not going to find much of that in there. This is about a true reinvention and an idea that if you lose your life to others, if you give yourself to other people, you get everything you ever wanted. But it's the long game. And I'm not unique. This philosophy has been around since the beginning of time. And every great philosopher, every great religious leader has all said something to this effect. It is crazy to me that we supposedly live in an age of enlightenment and awareness, and that ruthless, predatorial, it's all about me behavior is still the name of the game in commercial real estate and any other business you want to pick. It's insane. There is a huge disconnect.
Yeah. I mean, at some level, this has to come back to the nature of our unique species. We have brains that are designed to help us survive by gathering scarce resources in an environment of competition.
Yep.
I mean, this is Darwin kind of writ large here, and also reproduce ourselves. You take those two things and you spin them out and you get all the bad behavior imaginable. And at the same time, we have this incredible ability for self-awareness, for what the philosophers and cognitive scientists call metacognition. We can think about our thinking. And no other animal seems capable of doing that, at least as far as we understand it. We have a world that only reveals itself to us through language. And we have the ability to use our words to reshape our world. Not the world, necessarily. This chair doesn't care whether I say this is a good chair, a bad chair, a pretty chair, an ugly chair, my favorite chair, a horrible chair, etc. But
human
Or human beings for sure do, right? As Richard Rorty wrote years ago, the human self is not a physical phenomenon. It is a linguistic construct. So we're using language to remake the way we think and act, and our actions change the way we think and what we say about ourselves. It's the matrix, like,
yes.
You know, times a thousand.
Language creates everything.
Everything for us as human beings. So there's some, but yet there's some very interesting tactical moves that come out of this. So for example, Jonathan, in the book, when you talk in the chapter about having fun.
Yes.
You're not just talking about, you know, pinball machines.
No.
and happy hours and things. Maybe once in a while there will be rubber ducks thrown around.
More than once in a while.
But this is the chapter where you also talk about firing bad clients and being unwilling to tolerate abusive behavior from the people your people interact with, providing air cover. At first, I thought, well, this is just a place to throw that in because it didn't fit anywhere else, until I realized, no, this is the right place for that, because working in an environment where the clients create stress for the team is super unfun. So you're trying to get from some very kind of lofty things to some very practical things, how you negotiate contracts, how your team serves clients. It goes above and beyond some of these platitudes and these general ideas everyone would agree with. Can you give us a specific example from any part of the book that shows how Kaiser's team is executing on some of these ideas, whether it's truly one team or exceeding client expectations or treating your people like family or any of the core 15 principles?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, people ask me all the time, one, thanks again for the kind words. We're not perfect, right? Well, that's part of our culture. Is I don't want to be held to an impossible standard. I felt like I grew up with that in the church. And I don't want to put that on my people. So there's just like a, like you can't have fun if you're tense and you're stressed and oh my gosh, what's going to happen? And right. So first is like a, just a relaxing into like, hey, it's really at the end of the day, it's not that big of a deal, right? We got a lot going on. We're going to do our best and we're going to let the chips fall where they may. So there's that relaxed part that I think is necessary to create fun. But I also think that people perform at their very best when they're happy, right?
There's science around that.
There's so much science. So, like, I feel like I'm taking crazy pills half the time by saying the stuff, like somebody reads my book and they go, well, that's all the stuff I already knew. And I go, well, then why aren't you living it? I mean, hello. So it's not like I'm revealing new truths. It's just like showing that they actually work. For us, part of what makes Kaiser so special is that unlike most salesy type businesses, which commercial real estate brokerage falls under, we actually work as a team. Well, what does that mean? That means that we all actually want to help each other succeed. Do you know how opposite that is from most business cultures? Most business cultures, it's zero sum game. It's there's one fish. And there's two of us. And not only do I want to eat that fish, but I want to kill you and eat you because I'm hungry. And it's like, how insane is that? What if we said, if we both cut that fish in half, then what? So it's like there's this idea that we could actually help each other and succeed together. Then when it comes to the clients, we like to be irrationally overworking everything. We believe that going above and beyond is actually the best way to create long-term success. Well, what does that mean in practice? We spend 3 to 4 times per client requirement than any of our competitors. That sounds inefficient. It is inefficient until you think about the fact that we want to wow and blow away those clients to the level where they go, oh my gosh, Jonathan, not only are you amazing in what you guys did, but now can you help my friend? So we become this referral network by just taking really, really good care of the people in front of us. And then there's the way that people always ask, how do you get business? And this is the one that to me, I think is, and we give lots of these in the book on how to do this. Very practical. I'll just call her Nancy for now. We had a long pursuit of a big account and we ended up coming in second. This was years ago. And normally, if you're in an environment like that and you don't get the piece of business you've been trying really hard to get, you sort of have a chip on your shoulder, you write them off and you stop calling it. Well, for me and for Kaiser, that's not how we work because I just assumed, okay, that business wasn't meant for us today, but that doesn't mean there's not something for us in the future. And I'm still going to try to help everybody I can. So about 6 months later, I ran into this job opportunity that I thought, oh my gosh, that would be perfect for her. So called her up. Said, hey, have you heard about this job opportunity? I think you'd actually be great at it. And she's like, why are you helping me? And I said, well, that's what we do. And so she went and interviewed, ended up getting the job and was so grateful that she said, when I first met you, Jonathan, I sort of couldn't tell if you were for real or not. And that's why we went with the other firm. And now I realize, wow, you really are living what you preach. Can you help my new company with our real estate? And so it's just like this perfect example. I didn't do that to get her business. I did that because I wanted to serve and I saw an opportunity. Why do we withhold opportunities to serve? That would have been so easy for me to say, you know what? Screw her. She didn't pick me. She should have, because now I get to pay her back. No, no, no. That's a lose-lose. She doesn't get the job. I don't get a future relationship. And that's what I think is so small-minded about how business is done. Everybody's burning bridges behind them wherever they go. And it's like, why? How about you just, some of my best clients, some of my best partners came from people that I used to not see eye to eye with. Some of my best people that I recruited. All of these types of things all come from this idea of, what if you just strategically helped those people in the community that you want to do business with? And what if you found ways to love and serve them? And what if you had a long mindset versus a short game? What could you create? My life, when I tried to convince everybody I wasn't full of shit when I was, sucked. I was miserable, I was stressed out, and I wasn't nearly as successful as I could have been. Now today, right? And I'm not saying this to say, look at me. I'm just saying, whoa, if you could take a ruthless dude like me and have this be the other side, now everywhere I go, people say nice things about me. And I'm like, whoa, this is crazy. Because all I'm trying to do is help them. But when I was just worried about myself, nobody said nice things about me, even though I was trying to tell them I was nice. It's like this, everything's backwards. And so the whole point of the message, the whole point of the book, and the whole point of the firm is to show others that, look, this is possible. You can do it too. Here's my journey. Here's how I did it. Join us. Mm-hmm.
Sila, as a leadership development coach, you're often interacting with senior leaders who are in a state that we might politely call pre-breakthrough, where you can see something possible for them. Pre-breakthrough. It's a term of art.
I'm stealing that.
Yeah, I stole it. So you can carry away. It wasn't mine to begin with.
All right, good.
And you, the only way you have, your only toolkit for guiding them to what must be a self-discovery or it will never stick is the questions you ask and the conversations you invite them to have with you, but then with themselves. Can you talk a little bit about the methodology or the kind of art and science of leadership coaching? When you're sitting down with somebody who has the title, has the comp package, has the admiration of their people, and you're trying to get them to a place where they can have the kind of realizations they need to have to make a change, how do you go about doing that?
My approach is one that rests on the fact that most people are inherently good people. And most people actually want to do the right thing. Mm. So I never want to come into a room and be someone's mommy or, you know, be super prescriptive or be a preacher, because there is a tendency in this space that we can end up sounding super preachy or, you know, sometimes even condescending without intending to.
Yes, well said.
Right? And so for me, what's really important in those conversations is to just ask the right questions. It's a journey of self-discovery. I can't make anyone else discover it for them, but I can ask the right questions that can get there. There are also some tools out there that are helpful. So we talk about emotional intelligence quite a bit. And there's this piece of, you know, self-awareness, other awareness, and then emotional regulation. And there's some tools out there that can actually very tactically show people how they rate in terms of how they see themselves, how others see them, and then how they manage their interactions, their own behaviors, based on stimuli around them. And I think those tools, using those, have also proved very helpful in some of those conversations with leaders.
Yeah, it's a real trick. You know, we all have blind spots. We literally cannot see the back of our own heads. And if we get a mirror to allow us to do that, it's still our own eyes doing the looking. So finding ways to help others to see what was in their blind spot is a sensitive but very powerful way to get them to wake up, as you did, Jonathan, to the realization of, oh, I don't have to be a jerk. I don't have to be ruthless. There is another way. But it's not just that awakening that matters. It's the hard stuff that then has to happen.
Yes.
To make it real. And that's what you're laying out for us here in the book. You don't have to be ruthless to win. Now, this book seems to have four audiences, at least in my interpretation. You lay out three of them in the back of the book, and then one is implicit throughout. So the more general audience is anybody who feels compelled, as you did, to explore this idea, to think, you know what, maybe there is a better way. I could do something different. Whether they're a solopreneur, a small business owner, or an SVP, someone in the C-suite, they can see through your eyes what the journey looks like and kind of begin to explore for themselves. You put a lot of milestones and pointers and roadmaps and additional reading. And each of the 15 principles has follow-up actions. Do this, read that. This is how, you know, how to execute. But then you've also got several other audiences, people who might want to work in a company like Kaiser, who are tired of the environment in their current firm or their current organization. People who might want to hire Kaiser because now they really have seen this laid out in, I don't know how many hundred pages, 310 pages, that this is what you're really all about.
And they big font.
It's not actually. They may want you to handle their commercial real estate needs. And then there's a third audience, which I'd like you to talk a little bit more about because it shows something else in your evolution. Mm-hmm. And that is leaders of other organizations who maybe don't need commercial real estate and maybe aren't looking for a job, but who might want to do what you've done with their people. And you're actually creating a way to work with those people, which has nothing to do with real estate. Talk to us a little bit about your vision for the Kaiser Institute and how you're going to serve other companies on this mission to remake the way business is done.
Love it. Thank you. Well, first of all, on the first couple comments, you know, not only do we have everything that I could think of when I wrote the book on how to do it, but then as we started publishing it, we came up with more and more resources, and those are available on ruthlessbook.com. So if anybody reads the book or says, hey, how do I, we have tons of free stuff on ruthlessbook.com. We've actually created a vault for people to capitalize on that. My vision, my dream is a world where people selflessly help each other regardless of personal gain, understanding that it's in their own personal best interest to do so. What I'm trying to connect for people is success with service, not just do the right thing because it's the right thing. We all already know that. And the question is, are we living it or not? So this isn't like you said, I'm not preacher, right? I'm not interested in that. I'm a rational business leader saying, look, these principles work. They work to create success through service. So the whole Kaiser Institute idea is as people would walk through Kaiser's headquarters in Scottsdale, Arizona, they would say, wow, this is amazing. I can feel your culture. How do we do this? And so wrote the book and people are like, okay, but can you help us? And so we've created the Kaiser Institute to train, empower, and ultimately certify that next generation of selfless leader. But to your point, that's something that you have to want it. The biggest thing about this is you actually have to want to. So I think part of the problem with leadership programs as well is they're kind of being politely asked to take them and they don't really want to take them, but they don't have to work and they're getting paid anyways. And as long as they do the minimum, right? And then they come back, they learn some tricks and tools, and now they can manipulate even better, right? So this is this idea of reinvention from the inside out. You actually have to want to be a selfless leader. And for those people that really want to be, you can tell because they're hungry. They're hungry for more. They read my book and they say, you know, Jonathan, this was amazing, but I really feel like I need some personal help. And so we've designed all these curriculum from toe in the water, group kind of sessions to one-on-one helping leaders and helping organizations filled with leaders that say they want this as well, helping them create that for themselves. I mean, as we grow, our vision is to be a $1 billion company that completely reinvents commercial real estate from the ground up. So we're going to need all those audiences, right? We're going to need people that are listening to this and Atlanta and say, oh my goodness, I want to open up an Atlanta office. And we need, you know, the CEO for a manufacturing company in Houston that says, oh my gosh, I wish I had a partner like Jonathan. But at the end of the day, what we're really looking for is other leaders to catch this vision, to join us on this mission to change the business world through selfless service. And collectively, what could we do as a world? I mean, I get chills right now even saying it. Imagine what we could do if we all work together, help each other, you know, really tried to collaborate versus keep others away. Imagine so many things that could be possible, including our own personal success. And then there's all the additional stuff that nobody talks about, right? Which is like, oh my gosh, I'm actually happy. I actually love my life. I actually have amazing relationships with people because I spend my time investing in them. But it's like, oh, but that doesn't matter because this is business. Yeah, so you go work 90 hours a week and your whole goal is to make a bunch of money so you could be, oh yeah, happy. But everybody's missing that happy. So I'm saying, okay, you don't have to have success in lieu of happy. You don't have to have success in lieu of relationships. You don't have to have success in lieu of broken, you know, relationships with your kids. You can actually have it all.
Sheila, what does the future of work look like for you? I know you're on a mission. You've got a vision. What are you out to accomplish?
Look, here's the thing. The future of work is this. We have to find our humanity. AI can do the non-human stuff a million times better than we can. Our survival as a species, our survival as like in the workplace and how we deal with one another squarely rests on our ability and comfort level with being human. So the future of work for us is nothing short of being human, warts and all.
Mm.
Mark, do you want to come help with the Kaiser Institute? We'd love to have you.
So kind. I'd love to learn more.
So one of the things that we believe in here at Business Radio X is the power of relationships, the power of connections made over meaningful conversations. And I do feel like some of that is emerging here in the studio, and there are many follow-up conversations I'm excited for you two to have, for all of us to have. I want to wrap up our show today with a thank you. First of all, thank you, Jonathan, for taking the time, 8 years worth of time, to try to find the narrative that would make this book work. Without your personal story, this would just be a set of generic ideas. And as somebody who works with executives and with leaders to try to tap into the power of personal storytelling, I also know that this is not easy because you have to create a character in the book that's going to do the work you want it to do without somehow falling into the trap of ego that would either have you leave stuff out or put stuff in. So you really have to invent a vehicle for the change you want to do. And to the extent you've pulled this off, and I think you've done a great job, I think this is a book everybody should read for many reasons, including how to talk about your own personal story in a way that's ultimately not about you. That's a very powerful thing.
Thank you. That means a lot because that was honestly the hardest part.
Yeah. And I know that it is. And I think that's not something that until people have tried it, they don't realize how to use a personal story in service of others. And telling anecdotes that are unique to you and your life, but in a way that is ultimately not about you because other people hear themselves in them. That's what I do as a consultant. That's what we try to get people to do here in the studio. But you've certainly put a time and effort into that. So thank you for this contribution to our collective conversation.
It's my honor.
Sheila, as someone who is working in your own way to elevate organizations and the human experience, bringing your own background and rich perspective, thank you for the work that you're doing. I'd love to give you the final word today and really invite our listeners into an action, something that they can do. There's been a lot we've discussed. Obviously, one action is go read Jonathan's book. That's important. But if you had the top executives of the kind of organizations you've worked with listening into this, what would be your final word to them? What is the one next thing that they could do to move the needle for themselves and their people?
Define the story that you tell yourself about yourself. Taking your words, Adrian, define the story that you tell yourself about yourself, own that story, and then from there, decide what success actually means to you. It's likely not the Lambo and the chicks and the large house.
Yeah, very good. Owning that story, circling back to what you said at the beginning, the first realization is that you were authoring that story already. Maybe you could tell a different one. It's really great stuff. Thanks to you, Sheila Farani-Simmons, and Jonathan Kaiser for your contributions to this discussion today. For all of us here at Business Radio X, this is Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and we'll see you next time on Valley Business Radio.